Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is frankly when you download it to your iPod, iPad, computer, and then have the time to hit play. Today we have an interesting human interest show in law. You don't get these very often, and it's on how e-discovery education is being shaped around the country at a rapid pace through a collection of e-discovery professors. It showcases the power of a good idea and how the internet can make these ideas grow rapidly and be effectively executed. And as a result, it also highlights some of the power of some of the cloud computing tools that are out there. This is a great show to listen to if you want to hear a collection of e-discovery experts talk about how they're educating the next generation of e-discovery lawyers. In fact, one of the first programs I did with ESI Bytes was with Judge Shinlin and Ralph Losey to talk about Judge Shinlin's e-discovery textbook and how the next generation of e-discovery lawyers are so important to the field. This is also a really great show if you're in a region where there's a law school and it doesn't offer an e-discovery course. And by listening to some of these professors talk about how they're working together, you now have some resources to look to make a compelling offer to that law school to offer such a course without feeling like an isolated person. Our guests for the show are Bill Hamilton, who's the head of e-discovery at Quarles & Brady and teaches law school at the University of Florida, and he's also dean of the e-discovery department at Bryan University, teaching e-discovery online e-discovery courses. Steve Bennett is the head of e-discovery at Jones Day, co-head of e-discovery, and he teaches law school courses at Hofstra, New York Law School, and I think he's taught some courses at Brooklyn Law School, right, Stephen?
Correct.
We have Allison Skinner from Sirote Permute, who teaches e-discovery at the University of Alabama. And there's one other school in Alabama you teach at, right,
Allison? The School of Law, yes.
Okay. At some point, we might have Allison Haynes from the College of Charleston School of Law, and then Jennifer Smith from Florida A&M University College of Law and formerly litigator with Holland & Knight. Those are abbreviated introductions, but given the large number of guests, I thought we'd just start the show. Why don't we go in the order I just introduced you for no other reason than at least you've heard that, and talk about the law schools you teach at and where you work. And why don't we start with you, Bill, since you started this connection of professors here.
Well, thank you, Carl. Yeah, I'm Bill Hamilton, and I'm with Quarles & Brady in the Tampa office of Quarles & Brady, and I've been teaching at the University of Florida since 2007, electronic discovery and evidence, and more recently started a program with Bryan University, mostly directed at non-lawyers in e-discovery project management. We've kind of got this group going recently, and we're kind of excited about this show to let other potential adjuncts and individuals that want to get in the teaching of e-discovery, to let them know some of the resources that are available and share some of the trials and tribulations we've experienced.
And Stephen Bennett, you tell us a little bit about your background and the courses you've been teaching.
Okay. As I think we mentioned, the head of the e-discovery group here, which is sort of like herding cats in a firm that's as large as this. We have folks spread out all over the place, and we have them in various capacities, from lawyers to lit support to technical folk. I've been teaching a class in e-discovery, started at Rutgers several years ago. I taught it for 3 years there. They had not had a class before. Then I switched over to New York Law School, and I've taught that for 3 years. And then just this year, I taught for the first time at Hofstra, a short course. What they wanted was more or less a weekend experiential, almost like a NIDA style course, but something that was more focused on the process rather than the law. So that's my experience.
Okay. And Allison Skinner?
Thank you, Carl, for having us today. I really appreciate it. I started teaching e-discovery at the University of Alabama in 2010, and I wrote the teacher's manual for the West casebook. But some of the courses are using, and then other professors prepare their own course material. And I also teach it at a private law school, Thomas Good Jones Law School, and I took my class this past semester up to a 3-hour credit course, and I just think it's real important to promote the education on e-discovery. And I appreciate, Carl, a couple of years ago you had some law students on here talking about what it meant to them to have the opportunity to take those courses, and I appreciate you having that show earlier.
Thank you. We'll talk more about law students. This is one of the many failures in my life. There have been some successes along the way, too. It's been an organization I tried to launch with law students that was sort of similar to this one, but we'll save that question for later. What we did wrong, what you've done right type of a question. And then Jennifer Smith, you're the only full-time professor out of the group, but tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into teaching, where you're teaching, and your path to this position.
Hi. Before I joined FAMU College of Law, where I am now as an associate professor, I was a partner with Holland & Knight, and I joined FAMU College of Law in 2004. In about 2008, I started getting interested in e-discovery, realizing that it was a necessary course for students to be functional in as litigators and lawyers generally, litigators specifically, for the practice of law. And so I took courses, wrote on it, went and got certified by one of the vendors, and I started teaching e-discovery at FAMU's Law School last year in the spring. And it's scheduled to be taught again in 2013 and once every year thereafter at least. And most of the students have an interest in it because they've, you know, it's cutting edge. You know, without learning e-discovery, as one judge continues to say, that if you don't know e-discovery, you're essentially committing malpractice. And so this is a popular course at our school.
So each of you got a background in e-discovery at some point where you started before you became professors. So why don't we go down the list again and tell me how you got interested in electronic discovery. This is usually the first question we ask.
Right.
So, Bill?
Yeah, Carl. Well, you're right. I think most of us learned it the hard way in the trenches when it kind of snuck up on us, and we had to kind of invent various routines and strategies and approaches. So, you know, for me, that took place in the late 90s when I was had the privilege of representing some telecommunications companies with large volumes of data in terms of defending a couple of class actions. And we had to sort through customer records, millions and millions of customer records, looking for various kinds of information points. So all of a sudden, you know, I was facing problems I hadn't faced before. Now we call it electronic discovery. We didn't have a name for it back then. It was just figuring out how to do this in an economical, efficient, and rational way. So, you know, from that experience, I had a couple more cases, mostly involving metadata, actually, in terms of the turning point in the cases. So that was in the early 2000 time frame. And then, you know, realizing this was really a critical skill, kind of what I called a survival skill, we developed an in-house training program for the lawyers, and I was with Holland & Knight at the time. I think Jennifer might have just left at this point. And we offered, you know, a 10-week program on e-discovery. And that was kind of the genesis of my taking it to the law school, because I said, geez, you know, law students aren't getting the benefit of this for the most part in law school, and they're going to be stepping out into the world and they're going to get clobbered unless they have a basic sense of the ins and outs of e-discovery. So, you know, we've been teaching it kind of as a survival course, you know, for the past, you know, 5 years now at the University of Florida, with great student response and great success.
Okay, and we're doing this like in reverse order, you know, how I normally do things. But Stephen, how about yourself? How did you get involved in e-discovery?
Well, I'll try to be brief. I'm no computer scientist, although most of my friends from high school are either lawyers or computer technicians. I got a psych degree in college, basically became a commercial litigator, and the more at a place like this, Jones Day, the more the internet and email were beginning to influence how businesses communicated, the more we started seeing that in discovery and in trials. And so we formed a team in, I don't know, 99, something like that, basically to pull together the experiences that we had already developed, trying to develop some best practices. And as we were just mentioning, some internal training. Eventually started exporting some of that training to our clients as we began to realize that it's not just an outside counsel function. The inside folk need to know more about it as well. And then I started teaching the class at Rutgers. A pal of mine is the vice dean over there, and he actually, we were talking about various other things, but I suggested the idea of this class. He said, well, that's great. I had already taught at Brooklyn in another capacity, and developed the course over there. And it's kind of a schlep from Manhattan, so I decided to teach it at New York Law School. Maura Grossman is teaching the class now at Rutgers. I think she's in New Jersey, home in New Jersey, so it's a little bit easier for her. And then New York Law School has a program that's really designed to try to bring law students into the sphere of technical development. So this is one of several classes that they're offering. And then I mentioned the Hofstra thing where they wanted more of a NIDA-style experiential thing.
Well, you'll be sure to answer the question of helping others launch classes at law schools, because I got shot down the one time I tried, but we'll talk about that later in the show.
Well, I'm a very large and persuasive guy.
Yeah, I have to bring you as my counsel. Allison Skinner, your story in eDiscovery, how did you get involved?
Well, I feel like I've been doing eDiscovery before it was cool, similar to Bill and Steve. Started doing eDiscovery probably in the mid-90s, representing national clients, and it was just part of how we handled cases. And also, as Steve was describing, working internally with clients, I was fortunate enough to have clients that were anticipating the amendments in 2006, so several years prior to that, we were ramping up to be able to respond to discovery obligations in anticipation of those amendments. So I feel like I've been doing it a very long time, and I just had the opportunity to teach at Alabama and was real glad to do it, but felt that the education on eDiscovery was so important. I went to a small private law school and asked, would you also like for me to teach this course? Because they were limited to those who were willing to teach this course, and I was pleased that both schools wanted to offer it because they saw how important a course like this was for their students, especially as they're graduating and entering a very competitive market.
And Jennifer, yourself, how did you get interested in eDiscovery?
I had been teaching for a while, and I had not had much interaction with eDiscovery while in practice, but Ralph Losey, he wrote our dean about the importance of eDiscovery, and our dean gave the letter to all the CivPro teachers, and I was the only one who followed up with it, believing that it was important for our students. And so that was probably 2008, and that's when I started gearing up to learn about eDiscovery myself to be able to teach it for our students, which I started again, I think I told you, in 2011.
Well, that of course leads into a question which we'll ask at some point about how this board helps connect you into the world of practicing eDiscovery lawyers. I'm sure there's some help that you've seen from that or some stories. All right, so let's start the show first of all at a high level. Bill, you started the show and this program, and would you first care to respond to the rumor that it was an opportunity to grab a drink with some other lawyers at Legal Tech in New York City in January? Because then I saw a group appear after the drink. So you know, tell us about this.
Well, absolutely. That was the whole pretext for the group. No, of course not. But we did have a wonderful meeting at Legal Tech to kind of solidify things. What had happened is I had been receiving inquiries, for a number of years, asking, well, who's teaching here, who's teaching there, is there a group, do you have a list? We had done an event a number of years ago at Florida called an eDiscovery Evening, in which Patrick Goot and Ken Withers and Ralph Losey and some others came in and talked about eDiscovery with the students. And there was some idea of putting together a network at that time that never materialized. But I started receiving more and more inquiries about it, so I just took it upon myself and said, let's see if we can get everybody to collect the names of people who are teaching and where they're teaching and where they're working. So I collected the names of people I knew who I picked up over the years who were teaching and sent it out and said, let's start a list, and do you know anybody else? And then lo and behold, it was literally like a floodgate. Someone knew someone who knew someone, and you know, pretty soon we had a really vibrant and active group.
That's fantastic. So you know, Steve, you know, I'm going to ask if any of the other participants want to add something to your answer, but I'd like to ask you what's the biggest value you've seen from the group, and then if anyone else wants to chime in, that would be helpful.
Well, it's like most of the things that I've been involved with in the professional sphere. The essential value is the networking between people. When you get a group of experienced, interested people on the line, and somebody asks a question, you know, you get some spirited response, some of which is challenging, but all of which is interesting, and all of which is on target. And you know, folks are just trying to get it right, make it better, and you know, sort of advance the study in the area. And so that's that sort of mission. I think that felt sense within the group makes it easier for people to reach out and, you know, put out an inquiry and expect, you know, it's like karma, basically. You give and you get.
Okay. And anyone else want to add if you've seen any other value than that? Or?
Well, Carl, this is Allison Skinner. I can share just a personal experience. When I started teaching this, and Bill, you might want to chime in, but I think in 2010 there were maybe less than 20 e-discovery courses across the country. And Bill, you being a leader in one of the earlier e-discovery courses, does that sound about right?
Yeah, it sounds about right, if not over.
And so now we have, what, over 70 professors in this group teaching e-discovery?
Well, we have a group that's 70. You know, I don't think we've got 70 active classes going on. We have about 50 law schools represented that have offered e-discovery at one time or another or in one fashion or form of another.
And I think it's just great to have seen this group grow over, you know, very quickly over these last couple of years and being able to exchange ideas. And because this course is taught in real time, if you will, I think it's important that we keep our finger on the pulse of recent decisions, current technology, and other issues. It's not like, you know, where some property law has been around 1,000 years. Here we are getting cases issued that the next week we're teaching in class, possibly, because things are moving that quickly. And it's good to have a group that you can use as a sounding board to exchange ideas and, you know, what have you seen with this and get information. And so I'm really glad that Bill got it initiated and that we're having an opportunity to collaborate.
So, Bill, if you want to give an example of sort of an example of something that happened, how people are using the list.
Well, I think as Steve indicated, one way the list is being used is how do I teach this topic and how do I teach it well and what's the current law? I mean, you know, occasionally we'll be getting ready for class and you'll have your own question because, as Allison indicated, this is really cutting-edge stuff. There isn't a lot out there on every nuance to the practice of e-discovery. So, one, there's an instant communication vehicle. Second of all, what we've done is many of us have posted our examinations and our syllabuses from our courses that are on the public site that we have that's available for as a resource to one another. And I have had, you know, over the past couple of weeks, any number of individuals call me or contact me wanting to join the group specifically because they're getting ready to teach and they want to go out and offer it and they want to make a presentation, Carl, to a school. And where can I find some resources? How has it been done in the past? So, you know, here we can say, here's some syllabuses that have been used at various schools, saying here are some examinations that have actually been used. So you can get a real concrete sense of what's involved, what has to happen, and what's next. And what this does for the adjunct, and we all have day jobs, if you will, what this does starts with the adjunct, is it provides a resource that they can go to of collective work that's being shared, so that it's just not on their shoulders completely. You know, as Stephen experienced, as Allison mentioned, as I mentioned back 5 years ago, there was a kind of a sense of isolation. You felt like you were, you know, on your own. I'm inventing this from whole cloth. There's no reason to do that anymore. And what we've tried to do with this group is collect some resources that that newer classes and newer courses and newer instructors can use to benefit from the experience that some of us have had over the years.
Just got to keep the law students out of your sight. But anyway,
it is an admission only site, and I think we all modify our exams as we go. But yeah,
so,
good point.
So Jennifer, you've got an interesting perspective compared to the others, in that you're a full-time professor. How does this group help you stay connected to eDiscovery out in the field, and even to maybe preparing lessons? Is there any value in this that you're finding?
Yes, very much, because I don't get a chance to engage in the practice of eDiscovery as many of the people on the list. And so it helps me to prepare for my class and to get materials to use and to really keep up with the, you know, continually changing eDiscovery field. And so it's very helpful, as well as even when they send out the different exams and tests that everyone is using. I happen to teach different exams and tests that everyone are using now, but I happen to teach eDiscovery as a seminar currently only because I wanted my students to be able to write in an area that's not saturated with scholarship yet, and to give them something that, you know, may help them get a job, because they are writing on something that they have learned and can demonstrate that they have a knowledge in. And so it's a little bit different, I think, at this point, but the group has been tremendously helpful in terms of ideas, keeping up with the new materials, as well as, you know, certification, and trying to help my students, you know, get involved in being certified. And I've dealt with Bill's group and Ralph Losey's group, and I think that's, you know, it's been very helpful.
So Bill, I was curious, because I gave my example that I tried to teach at a university and was told there wasn't a need. And I'm sure, and I've talked to some of the people that are teaching at some of the other schools, this is not a unique response. Do you see any ability of this group to offer testimonials from different classes to package to sell the idea to law schools that are on the fence that, hey, this is worthwhile? I mean, are we still too early even to think about that? Because you've only been doing this now for like 3 or 4 months.
Well, good idea, Carl, and I think the group would be very open to that. I think the existence of the group itself is testament to the need for it, and all of us can share our experiences with students. You know, what we haven't talked much about is the value to students of teaching eDiscovery, how critically important it is, as well as the value to the law profession itself. I mean, we've got to keep the civil litigation process going, and mastering eDiscovery and having fundamental eDiscovery skills is critical to that mission. So it's hard for me to comprehend how a law school wouldn't perceive the value teaching eDiscovery right now. There's a student demand for it. There's lots of experience that it works, that students like it, that it can produce results that are measurable and consistent. And I think you're right. We can stand up as a group and make this point compellingly for almost anybody.
Importantly, there are jobs out there for people that have the understanding of the technical area crossing over with law. I mean, it's a growth field.
I think the job aspect is the biggest selling point, to be quite frank. And recently I presented on eDiscovery to the faculty at our school, and because we had I did teach eDiscovery in 2011, but it was not on the syllabus in 2012, and it was a unilateral decision made by the associate dean. And on their own, more than a handful of the full-time faculty went to the associate dean and said, you must put that back on the curriculum, on the schedule, every year. So people are recognizing more and more the need, even if they don't know anything about eDiscovery, or even if they don't even currently litigate.
Just to give you an example, Carl, of how important it is to the students, I had one of my students who was a second year, and in the summer before his third year, he was clerking, and he was able to present a CLE-type program, like a lunch and learn, to the partners and other associates in the law firm where he was clerking on e-discovery. And when do you ever see the occasion where a law student has that opportunity to share legal information with practicing attorneys? I mean, that was a great opportunity for that student.
Yeah, when I started in law, I came in from an accounting background, and we were in a trial, and I was the only one that knew how to use PowerPoint. This was back in 96, and it was like I was like buying Manhattan from the Indians. I mean, it was like you can create this on a computer. How powerful. And it's not that bad. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the people on the show are testament to some of the strength in the community, but there's certainly lots of need for additional people to be joining. I think we would all agree.
It's kind of interesting, picking up what Allison was saying, Carl. At the beginning of my classes, I tend to go around and ask the students, well, why are you in e-discovery, and how did you happen to come here? And, you know, 5 years ago, you had some adventuresome types that said, I suspect this is important, I had heard about it. But other students would say things like, well, it seemed more interesting than taking art law, and answers like that. Now what I'm getting when I go around the classroom and ask people why they're in the class, half the class is saying, well, I was clerking, and my partners told me to make sure I take this course because this is a valuable skill. So what's happening is the law students are getting the message that law firms are demanding these skills, need these skills, and that's why they're coming into the courses. You know, in Florida, we teach it every semester at 40 in my next class, and it filled up in a day.
Actually, one tragic aspect of that is the fact that many of the schools treat this as an upper-level course and restrict access, and the result is that you have third-year, whatever, seniors taking the class at a point at which, you know, they're about to enter the work world. It would be so much better if something like this were incorporated, at least in part, into some of the earlier experiences, you know, civil procedure, evidence, et cetera, to, you know, kind of seed some understanding, that's S-E-E-D, some understanding of this topic before, you know, it's not something that you should be learning, you know, the minute you're walking out the door.
And secondly, if you're in your first year and you're at a university that's got a robust curriculum across different departments, you might be able to, you know, sign up for an entry-level computer science type of a course. And when you have time and some flexibility, you know, supplement your background so you look a little bit different from the other lawyers leaving law school, and have you know, a little bit of depth that would be harder to pick up once you've left.
Right. There are plenty of ways I can think of to expand and actually integrate a course like this, especially the idea of, you know, getting people out to do some of the training programs that various vendors offer. I mean, they'll do it for free. It's like the old days with Lexis and Westlaw, where in substance, not to put it delicately, they were trying to get people habituated to using those services. And so they were willing to provide law students with free access to the services. Well, the same thing is involved here. They see a market for future users of their services, and so long as it's under control in the sense that it's not a total commercial, there's a possible win-win sort of arrangement there.
So, you know, one of the ways this network can be helpful is, you know, just to give the listeners a sense, I just had this idea of trying to pitch to the law school that I wanted to teach the class at. I could send an email out and hit, you know, or get the attention of 50 different programs around the country that are teaching this. Hey, do you have any data on how accepted or popular your class is? And I think I would probably get at least 20 emails, given my tracking of this, of feedback from adjuncts or professors that have that type of data, and say, yeah, we're getting rated, or we're full, you know, or sign up filled up in a day. you know, and then it's easy. I mean, that's how it works, right, Bill?
Absolutely.
Well, I get the response from the students that after taking the class, they feel like it's a class that they'll actually use in practice, and they feel like it's a very practical class that they will benefit from, and it'll also help them, you know, find a job. And I think that helps with the students responding as well as we have seen it.
Well, that's all great. Now let's talk about the success of the cloud, Bill, because you've shown in a real interesting way, and I thought about this about an hour ago before we started the show, that you threw all these cloud materials together of, you know, joining a group, email listservs, document storage. You care to talk a little bit about, you know, your IT infrastructure that you've thrown together as sort of a case study and how this can work, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, Carl, it's not really complicated. You know, I've kind of, you know, done it just with the tools that are available. You know, we used Dropbox initially, and now we've migrated to another location called GroupSpace. And, you know, we simply have created folders and loaded the materials onto folders, and there's an access that can be granted for every member of the group to use and access the folder. So it's real simple. It's just elementary stuff. I think what was really surprising was once we started the group, and the reason we ended up going to a cloud location was people started passing around syllabuses, examinations, cases they're using, recent memoranda that had been filed in this case or that. And we came to the conclusion of, look, as we're adding new members, they're not going to get the benefit of the stuff that's previously been circulated unless we have some archive or repository. So naturally, we turned to the cloud for that immediately and have created a location that's going to keep our dialogues and keep our debates and keep the materials so that, you know, newer members can see it and older members can go back and use it whenever they deem it's appropriate without having to, you know, fiddle through your email or find it in your email thread or your particular folder. So it's a real handy way of going about it. And I think you're right, Carl, it really illustrates the value and power of the cloud.
Now, I you know, to I don't want to end on my failures, but you know, I did try and I didn't put a ton of time into this, but I had a couple of law students that wanted to build a site called Law Blog Review. So I bought the domain. I got a couple of judges involved that were very interested in promoting the idea, just in general as a good idea, and then it didn't go anywhere. Couldn't hit any critical mass with students. Do you have any advice for the law students? Because I know I actually have a lot of law student listeners in this space on, you know, the power of getting material out there and building an expertise while you're in law school. I guess that's a rather unfocused question. But anyone want to weigh in on this?
Carl,
Allison, you were involved in the failure.
Carl, I don't mind weighing in. Or go ahead, Jennifer.
Oh, I was just going to say I had a different experience. A number of students formed a student e-discovery group at the law school so that they could have speakers and kind of branch out from the class as to, you know, to build their knowledge base with e-discovery because we only have one e-discovery class. So I had a bit of a different experience, I guess, with the students.
Yeah,
Carl, I had a similar experience because I started a LinkedIn e-discovery student group and had a very hard time getting participation. And I don't think it's necessarily the idea. I think it's law students in general, they're focused on their classwork and getting ready for exams and taking on it, quote, an extracurricular activity sometimes is challenging to their schedule, not that they're not interested. It's just finding the time, especially if they're doing moot court or trial ad and things like that. But I think that as the space does continue to grow, there'll be an opportunity to revisit lawblogreview.com.
Yeah, I own the domain for at least one more year. And, you know, if anyone, I know we've got plenty of students listening because I gave a lecture at the University of Pittsburgh 2 weeks ago with Judge Fisher and Tom Grix and Ann Peterson and a couple of other people, Joe Domeno. And you know, the students there had great ideas, much like you said, Jennifer, in terms of, you know, some of the networking. It was a group that put this on, that sponsored it, asked us to come in and speak, And then one of the students afterward told me of just a great article he was working on that was cutting-edge stuff. And I thought, what a great application of technology and law. You know, you should be marketing these ideas through some type of a platform.
So. Well, there's also a number of efforts to organize. You know, there's education programs, not just CLE programs, but certification groups and that sort of thing. And it seems to me that there's a natural affiliation between the academics who are involved in this and those sorts of training groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Carl, this is Allison again. This network and Jonathan Redgrave's firm, Redgrave LLP, they had a writing essay contest on eDiscovery this past fall. And one of my students placed second and received a substantial scholarship recognizing him placing second in that contest. And I thought that was a great way of promoting eDiscovery, connecting the law firms with the law students, and and also it was, you know, great benefit to receive scholarship money.
Yeah. I'll tell Jonathan to unload that material on Law Blog Review and help the students further. But
right.
Anyway, well, enough about my ideas, because I'm, you know, this is about a successful idea on this with the professors. Bill, how should a listener contact you if they want to teach a law school class or contact anyone involved in this to get more information or to get involved? Maybe they're teaching somewhere and they didn't even know about this and they want to get involved.
Well, it's real simple. Just send me an email at william.hamilton@quarles.com, and I'll send you an invitation to join, and you'll have ready access to the materials.
Fantastic. Now I'd like to go around the list. I just always like to ask people these questions to help give me ideas for future shows. But what do you see as the top issue right now in eDiscovery? And why don't we go reverse order since we've been – why don't we start with Jennifer, then Allison, Steve, Bill, then yeah, that's the list. So, Jennifer, if you have any ideas on that?
The top issue from whose perspective?
Yours.
Well, that's a good idea. Well, I think the top issue, at least as a law professor, is to get this to the students. I think that those of us who know eDiscovery know the value of eDiscovery. I think we have to figure out how to educate students. Lawyers still, I still do some practice on the side, and lawyers still are totally unaware of eDiscovery. And I find that remarkable. And so I think it's incumbent upon us, those of us who are educating in eDiscovery, to make sure that we get it to the students quickly, competently, and for certain, you know, surely that we get it to the students, because so that there are not some of the lawyers out there who are practicing without knowing the value of eDiscovery. So I think we have to educate our students.
Okay, and how about you, Allison?
Well, I mean, I think the hot terms right now in eDiscovery are predictive coding. Everybody's watching and reading these recent opinions and following those. I think that's a hot issue right now. In my line of work, because I co-founded the American College of eNeutrals, I've been promoting the use of ADR for eDiscovery disputes and working with some courts to help develop ADR programs. So in my world, that's been a top issue for me. But I definitely think if you look at all the blogs right now, it's unpredictive coding.
Boy, and I tried to go through a complete show. We almost did it without mentioning that. So
sorry.
Yeah, sorry. We came close. So Steve Bennett, your take on the field right now?
To me, the major issue, and this is both for teaching this class and for eDiscovery in general, is proportionality and scaling of both the law and the technology. One of the big problems, it seems to me, is that the marquee cases that get a lot of attention tend to be big dollar, big document cases. Predictive coding, for example, is only appropriate for very, very large volume cases. And so trying to scale some of the concepts that we have as to how to manage what these are really just projects, if you think about it, how to manage these projects in an efficient way for medium size and smaller size matters, how to scale the education as well for practitioners or law students who are unlikely to be working in a big dollar, big volume area, but still want to have some understanding of the subject matter.
Steve, it was the first show I did with Judge Facciola and a solo practitioner with the ESI Bites was on that topic. I couldn't agree with you more that that's an important topic, as well as everyone else's topic. So, Bill, how about yourself?
Well, just following on what everybody said, I think the focus is e-discovery project management. You know, it's not merely the law, it's not merely the vendor community and the technology. It's the integration of those two and that critical juncture that's so important right now, both out in the field and training our new lawyers how to do it and how to think that way. So we are in a scalability problem. We're in a post, what I like to call a post-relevance world, where proportionality dominates everything. And you know, we've got to figure out solutions going forward and educate our attorneys to be on how to do that.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you, Bill, Steve, Allison, and Jennifer, for joining us here at ESI Bites. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Juranov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. It sounds out phonetically as Easy Bites of ESI information, if you want to remember it that way. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.